Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
All right, Pete, I got an idea for today's podcast.
All right, I'm frightened already.
Well, we have nothing except for this asshole Eberhardt, or what's his name? Earhart?
Earhart.
Amelia.
Congressman who's...
Mr. Amelia.
Doing bad things to tech.
Yeah. Anyway, everyone might want to look up Representative Earl Earhart and find out what exactly
he
thinks is important. From the 36th
District of Georgia, I believe, West Cobb.
Anyway, I have a new podcast.
You have a nude podcast? How do people see if you're naked or not? It's a podcast.
You're the sweetest man I ever met, Pete. No, I have a new podcast, a library podcast.
Okay, really? Do people listen to library podcasts?
You want to hear it?
Yes. Hit me.
From the Georgia Tech Library, this is Library 2020. This episode is called In the Stacks, Part 1. So here's the thing that's going to happen. The Georgia Tech Library is moving most of its books to a high-density storage facility 6 miles away from the main library building. This plan is making some people question whether we'll still be a library. Books, as they say, are the library brand. What do we lose when we take the library's print collection out of the building? This is an important question for two very different reasons. The first reason is simple. We need to know. If we're designing the library of the future, a process we're calling the Georgia Tech Library Renewal, then for every choice we make, for every tradition we change, we need to know what we lose and what we gain to be sure that this renewal business is worth it. The other reason the question is important is the way it's phrased. We aren't getting rid of the books. We're taking them out of the building. Our patrons will still be able to use and browse the book collection, just not in the way they do it now. So what do we lose? And when I say we, I actually mean the patrons. There are three things we lose if the book collection is not open to the public. Browsing through proximity, immediacy of access, and the material joy of the stacks. I could probably do a podcast on each of those. So I will. Let's start with browsing through proximity, or what some people think of as serendipitous discovery. So I want you to imagine browsing. Picture yourself, close your eyes, picture yourself standing in front of a shelf of books. It's about 3 feet long. There's a shelf above it and a shelf below it. Those shelves are full of books too. And the book you're interested in is right there in the middle of the middle shelf. Let's say it's The Life and Death of Whales by Robert Burton. When you find this thin blue-green book, all around it will be other books that might interest you, like more books about whales, and books about dolphins, and books about polar bears, and books about cheetahs and vampire bats. I'm serious. There's a book about vampire bats on this shelf with the whale books. Here's why. The Life and Death of Whales by Robert Burton has a call number, QL737.C4B87. 1973 B, created using the Library of Congress classification scheme. The Q of QL737 marks this as a science book, and the L makes this part of the subclass zoology. QL737 is within the range of vertebrates, that is 605 to 739.8, and between 700 and 739.8 are mammals. And then inside that range, 737 is systematic lists. That's books about whole orders of animals. After the QL737, in the call number, we get C4. That signifies cetacea, marine mammals, as opposed to C2, which is carnivores, or P9 for primates. There are many more designations for other animals if you want to go down the rabbit hole, which would be under L32 for lagomorphs. QL737.C4 That's science, zoology, mammals, cetaceans. And then the B87, that's for the author's name, Burton. The 1973 B is for the year of publication. And to be honest, I don't know what that B at the end is for. I mean, this was cataloged a long time ago. Who knows what was going on? Altogether, that call number makes a unique identifier. QL737.C4B87-1973B, encoded with information about the book. All the books have those call numbers, and we use those call numbers to mark the book's locations in the stacks. That is, the way they are ordered on the shelves with other books. We shelve by alphanumeric order. After all the QL737s, you'll find the QL738s, miscellaneous, the junk drawer of classification. When you find a book in the stacks, you can look at all the other books around that spot on the shelf, and you'll find that they're similar in content, because that's what the classification system sorts them by. The fear, if we take the books out of the library, so that you have to look them up online, is that if you're not looking on the shelf for the book, you won't discover another book that's right up your alley. Which might be true if you're just typing into search fields and requesting books from the library catalog like you're ordering from Amazon. But there are always ways to get back more results than just the single item you search for. With linked data and virtual browsing, the digital catalog might make up for losing that proximal serendipity. Here's how. I have in my hand a copy of Moby Dick. I also have a hammer and a bunch of 1.5-inch nails. Leaving aside the hardware for a moment, I want you to picture the text of the novel winding its way across all the pages. You know, starting with, "Call me Ishmael." Melville put those words in a very particular order. Just like a classification system can put a bunch of books in a particular order. If we think of each word in Moby Dick as a book on a shelf that runs infinitely almost, left to right, top to bottom on every page, then the novel can be our metaphorical library stacks. Call is shelved next to me is shelved next to Ishmael. Call Me Ishmael starts the shelves, but let's stick with the whales, not the sailors. Chapter 32 of Moby Dick is called Cetology, and on page 147 of the 1999 Pocketbooks paperback of Moby Dick, there is a line. To be short, then, a whale is a spouting fish with a horizontal tail. Let's leave aside the accuracy of that line and say if we're looking for whale in that sentence, then we find all around it the words short, spouting, and fish. That's browsing by proximity. Browsing digitally is more like finding that sentence in the book, taking one of those nails I mentioned earlier, and pounding it through the word whale and into the book. Okay, I know some of you are horrified that I just hammered a nail through a book, but I wanted to get your attention. I bought this copy of Moby Dick for $2 at the Book Nook, and I promise they didn't pay me to say that. And this hole is very small. So there's a nail through the book, a metaphorical digital search through my metaphorical library of twisting shelves. And after I pull the nail out, we can look at what other words I've found, or pierced with my search. So here's a set. Agencies, terrors, unfortunate, gate, measurement, minutes, boats, and squall. Those are just 8 of the 417 words my nail hit as it went through the book. And just in case you were wondering, I really did pound a nail through a copy of Moby Dick. I wouldn't lie to you about something like that. So a search through the virtual bookshelf, a search that can cross classifications and is unlimited in its reach, that can create far more serendipity than any browse of the physical stacks. That's a search that can pick up The Life and Death of Whales, and Leviathan, and Moby Dick, and Hunted Mammals of the Sea, and The Wreck of the Essex, and 2 Star Trek films, The Wrath of Khan and The Voyage Home. So we have to accept that you won't be able to walk up to a book and then look around it. But the catalog can replicate that proximity and then transcend it. You won't be limited to a few shelves and what catches your eye. You can browse the whole library from anywhere while drinking a cup of coffee. We will lose that physical proximity. That means you can pull another book off the shelf when you find the one you're looking for. But we can redefine proximity. We can make closeness out of all kinds of qualities, not just those particular call numbers. And we can make robust and magical searches out of our metaphorical nail through the book. We'll talk more about virtual browsing later. Next time, immediacy of access for In the Stacks Part 2. This is Library 2020, a podcast about the future of libraries. I'm Charlie Bennett, and I wrote and produced this episode, which is called In the Stacks Part 1. Our theme music is The Informant by Steelism, and in this episode you heard The Zeppelin from Blue Dot Sessions. And right now we're listening to I'll Become Everything by Nick Jaina. You can sign up at my website to receive the show notes by email. That's charliebennett.org, two N's and two T's. Just click on Library 2020 on the front page and you'll find the web form. The podcast is on Twitter at lib2020podcast. And so far, we've got no reason to be on Facebook or Google Plus or whatever else. Thanks for listening. And don't worry about my copy of Moby Dick. I've got plenty more. So there you go. That's the most recent episode.
Defacing books, really?
That's the most recent episode of Library 2020.
That's basically the equivalent of nudity, which we suggested for this podcast in the beginning.
So there you go. What do you think?
I like it because the idea of proximity searching is something that has caused me to discover amazing things in science engineering. I mean, not only do you just see the books next to you, and I will admit this, I will look up one or two books. I will go to the library and I will often come home not with the two books I looked up, but with the four books that are in that section, according to the Library of Congress classification.
That's a pretty classic
system.
Use of the library.
Yeah. And then sometimes, even when you go to a journal and you look at the journal, you find the journal issue in which your article is listed is...
This is something you've mentioned a few times. Yeah.
It's dedicated to that whole topic.
I find that very interesting, the idea that... you know, the browsing by serendipity or the browsing by proximity can even happen like within the text that you find.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But you can also do that, like when you look up an electronic journal, a digitized journal these days,
right?
It's all there. You'll see. You know, you'll see the note
because you look at it by issue, and it will. You'll look at all the articles in that will have a similar topic, and it's the topic you're interested in, so you immediately find it. But with books, it's a little bit harder. I would like this bizarre digital proximity searching of which you speak.
Why do you think it's bizarre? Did you get the nail through the book?
Yeah, I got the
analogy.
I'm not sure that's the greatest algorithm for searching. This word showed up in the same space on the page 37 pages later after you pounded a nail through it.
Okay, well, now you're taking away the poetry a little
bit. That's okay. You know? Okay, but it is an algorithm. It may not be the best algorithm, but it's one.
I'm just saying, like, if you imagine that every single word it represents a book, right?
Yeah, no.
That instead of having to go along like an infinite line from left to right and say, oh, well, next to this is next to this and next to this, you know, the library is essentially
this is me
all
punching my fist through the shelf,
right, and going out farther into
maybe
the world.
Not the best algorithm to find things that are related, but there are better algorithms that are even better than adjacency in the Library of Congress classification system.
Well, it doesn't have to be just adjacency; it can also be matched keywords.
Yeah.
It could be matched title words.
Right.
You know, in the whale analogy, the Moby Dick analogy, the crazy thing with that is that just the reference of Moby Dick, say in Wrath of Khan, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan.
Does he actually refer to Moby Dick or did you just talk about whales?
Well, it's... from hell's heart, I stabbeth thee. With my last breath, I spitteth
thee.
There
you go.
Thee.
Yeah.
I mean, that's an explicit, quote from the book. From
why
Moby
would
Dick.
A Klingon quote and
Khan's not a Klingon
book? I thought he. Oh, he's not.
No.
What is he? Oh, he is a human.
I don't know if he's a human. I don't really care about the story behind all this. I mean, Wrath of Khan is awesome because it's awesome. It's not awesome because of the story.
All right, I don't want to nitpick. Yeah.
Like, Khan is some kind of super engineered human, and he was
Let loose the dogs of war. That's what you like.
But
so do I.
It's like, it's Captain Ahab's self-consuming revenge fantasy is what Khan has.
Right.
Right. And that's you know, Moby Dick, there's all kinds of ways that you can pull apart Moby Dick, whether it's as a, you know, an archive of technical practices of the 19th century.
Or a religious allegory.
Or
that's really like nails on a chalkboard for you. I know it's not. I just like saying that.
I mean, certainly the understanding of the great void that is the whiteness of the whale, you know, the whole, the sublime, like the terrifying sublime, the actual sublime, not the, like, you know, rub me down sublime, right? Mm-hmm. Is religious in a way, but it's not an allegory.
I agree.
Which a teacher once pinned me to the wall over in
a
class.
They said it was an allegory?
Was not.
Oh, I agree with you. I had a teacher do the opposite. My senior English teacher in high school
said it was an allegory?
It was an allegory. In fact, he wrote his master's thesis at Wheaton College on it. And that's Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois, which is extremely religious.
Okay, I have to read this. So I'm putting it in my phone. Right now, during this recording, I'm putting this shit into my phone. What was the name of your
professor?
I'll
have to look it up.
No,
I don't remember the guy.
Unacceptable.
Mr. something
Wheaton,
or other.
How do you spell Wheaton?
W-H-E-A-T-O-N.
Wheaton College.
And Wheaton College in Wheaton, Illinois. And it's a very conservative religious school. Look up theses, Moby Dick, religious allegory, I guess.
You can't remember the guy's name?
No.
What a jip.
I'd have to look him up in my yearbook. This much I will say is I disagree with his interpretation of Moby Dick as a religious allegory, but I think he was a very dedicated, passionate, talented teacher who inspired me.
The particular thing about allegory, it's almost like a pedantic kind of...
Yeah.
Well, it's not an allegory. It's a broad analogy.
It's allegorical-like.
Like, Pilgrim's Progress is an allegory because, like, explicitly each thing that happens is... It has a meaning. Like, it has a code.
Yeah, the Chronicles of Narnia is an allegory.
Is it? Wait. See, that's the thing.
I believe C.S. Lewis, the author, said it was.
But when we talk about the literal allegory, right?
Oh, then it's not really an allegory anymore, is
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
Yeah, like, you're right. Like, it is a retelling.
And you could say it's allegorical and all that and be right enough for conversation, but for like actual scholarship, for very explicit...
This conversation bores me.
Okay.
Off with your head.
I'm cool with that. What do you think of the Chronicles of Narnia?
I think they're a fascinating story. I read them to my children and all the subsequent books, actually. I think they're great stories.
I always wonder about the whole, the lion, Christ as the lion, or the religious, not religious faith, but the belief as the lion, you know, the sort of the strength and violence of it. There's always that Jesus in the temple throwing out the money changers.
Is the money changers? Yeah.
That, you know, that's the Jesus for me. But I think that's the only time he does something like that, right?
Other than that, he was a pretty mellow dude.
Yeah. When he says, let he without sin cast the first stone or whatever he says, does he actually then hit the guy with the stone?
No.
Like, hey, jackass. I mean, it's sort of a Three Stooges kind of thing.
That would be the money changer, dude. Like, let he is without sin cast the first stone. Allow me to illustrate. Wham!
You know, that is one of my favorite lines ever from a Coen Brothers movie, from Barton Fink. Have you heard this one?
No, I didn't watch Barton Fink, actually.
Barton is talking to a producer. He says, well, where can I find a writer? He says, a writer? Fink, this place is full of them. Throw a rock and you'll hit one. And do me a favor, Fink. Throw it hard.
People don't like writers. But without writers, stuff would be impossible.
Well, from what the writer's strike made it clear, you could still have a lot of stuff with the writers on strike. Anyway.
Oh, bummer.
Narnia. So you are an atheist, and you're sort of
actively atheist. I don't know. I'm an
atheist.
I'm an agnostic. I don't know what the metaphysical truth of the universe is, but I don't walk around persecuting the crap out of people that are religious, because most of us were religious when we were young. Religion is like a hat. Your parents hand it off to you.
Religion is like a hat.
Someone else said that. It doesn't quite fit right.
Is that an allegory?
No. So for my money, Jesus of Nazareth was a carpenter who preached peace, love, and understanding. I don't know if much of what is written about him is true. We don't have a good historical record of him. But I like his attitude. I like the philosophy, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. And in fact, biblical scholars have analyzed that, and they're not even sure Jesus said that. It's written in a very different style.
Well, I mean, my...
But then to me, it doesn't matter. It's a good philosophy.
The place I land with all that stuff is that none of it is true. Yeah, that no one said any of that. That it was
that's
just
very possible.
That just, it's like
it's made up crap.
George Washington saying, you know, I cannot tell a lie. I chopped down the cherry tree.
But I like the parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, and that story of the stoning in the square. I live my life by those philosophies, as do a lot of other smart people.
Not always.
I try. No, not always. Right, when I'm in Atlanta traffic and like I'm flicking people off, I am
of
judging.
That.
I'm like, what are you, an idiot? I'm judging. I admit that.
I feel like that's the hole we fall into. That, and that by hole, I mean like that's the deep, dark problem that we fall into is that there's always something that's not. Do you hear that in the headphones?
I believe it's an airplane buzzing the studio.
It's like, those fuckers are talking about religion. They're talking about Chronicles of Narnia and Moby Dick. If you can't hear it, dear listener, there's like a...
How did we get from library proximity searching to Moby Dick and religion?
Well, the Moby Dick was in the podcast. Okay.
Yeah, I don't really believe it's a religious allegory.
Did you like my podcast? That's
I loved it. It was very professionally done. I felt as though I was listening to a British documentary. When we're here at the library. But who really cares? Let's move on then, shall we? You know, it was good stuff.
Like I'm trying to apply I'm trying to apply all my tools to a research question.
You have tools?
I do. I got at least one.
Okay.
All my tools.
Again, it's not a nude podcast, so I don't want to see it. But
all my tools, Pete.
You made your case.
All my tools.
I have experienced the joy
of
proximity searching in the library. You go there and you run your fingers over the smooth spines of the volumes and you say, oh, dear God, I hadn't planned on picking up this book, but this is the book I need. We will
When's
need.
When's the last time anything like that happened to you, though?
I haven't been in the library in a while.
You know, it happened to me recently where I pulled a couple books off the shelf that I hadn't planned
to get.
Were
you nude in the stacks?
But
that's
here's
the
thing. I didn't end up reading them. I don't have time to just kind of say, oh, yeah, that would be great. Like, I don't have time to read the stuff I want to read.
Yeah, I have a stack of 4 or 5 books.
Do you know how many books I get? Like,
and I listen to books on tape.
A month?
Do you?
I get like 10 books as review copies a month. Wow. I can't even read one. I can't even read one. How did I end up in this position?
You're doing all these podcasts, that's why. Cut that out of your life, you could read.
If you check the dates on that Library 20, I think that one I did at the end of January. I have been a very poor podcast producer.
Right, but it was well done.
Thank you.
And it reminds people of the importance of this proximity searching. And it basically says, as the new digital library goes forward, we must have something that mimics this proximity searching. Okay, maybe not the joy of touching the books in an impure manner, but being able to...
Well, those were the three things I talked about. I said, you know, there's browsing by proximity, immediacy of access, mm-hmm. and then the material joy of the stacks. Like, I think those are the three things that if you pull them out, pull the book collection out of the library building...
Right.
Those are the three things you have to engage and see, like, what are we losing? Because all the other stuff, like...
The pleasure of the stacks, though, I think people are going to let that one go.
They're going to let it go, but you can't just say, shut up. You know, you got to, like, there's more to people's enjoyment of the stacks than just, oh, I like how it's nice. What are you laughing at?
For me, at the University of Illinois... only undergraduates that were James scholars like myself were allowed in the stacks. Otherwise, you had to have someone go back and get the book for you. There was a lot of making out in the stacks.
I tell you, Pete, imagining
it's like
you
a cheap
as
motel
a
room
of some exclusive club is
it wasn't that exclusive.
Fills me with joy.
It was not that exclusive. And the University of Illinois. So I was a James scholar, and that really came with nothing. You got to go in the stacks. That's it. It's like, yeah, you get a napkin with your cheeseburger. You know, I mean, this is nothing.
Really, there's no room in the Georgia Tech, no place. There's certainly room, but there's no privacy in the Georgia Tech book stacks where you could make out. you know, or whatever.
No, it's way in the back. I mean, do people really visit there all that much? I mean, all I know is,
but other places, what my point is, other places have a much more Warren-ish, a labyrinth.
Oh, okay. Yeah. We are pretty much a big rectangle.
It's like, boom, there's a square. It's sort of like the Emory, Emory Tower.
And Illinois is a big land-grant university. We have a bigger collection because we've got a lot of this humanities stuff as well.
I think Michigan's library, University of Michigan, was one where you could get to a place where not only were you discreet and protected, but also no one could approach without a lot of warning.
Yeah, I believe that, if you're far enough away. Yeah. But yeah, University of Illinois did not handle it well. They gave me the privilege of going in this dark, dank, you know, building with bookshelves in it. But
that old mold smell.
Yeah, but the scholarship they gave me my first year, they said, hey, and this is contingent upon funding, and they cut my funding sophomore year. So I will never, ever donate money to the University of Illinois. Do they not understand that that is a bad faith action that will only hurt them? And now with their legislature not even agreeing with their governor
an engineer
on budgets,
and find some, you know,
I am not happy with that. I put myself through school. I could have used that money so they can kiss my hairy ass. That's basically it, man.
Pete, this is not a nude podcast. You can place that ass back in his pants. Okay. Well, now that you're dressed.
Okay.
Any other thoughts? Oh, I wanted to tell you about my tools.
Okay.
I just want to apply.
Please do.
There you go. I just want to, you know, I want to explore this question of what is a library of the future, What's
and
the library
now? Isn't
that
what your podcast is doing?
Yeah. And I want to do that. But I'm saying broadly, like the thing I want to do is answer this question. Because here I am at work, and one day, I mean, it was a lot more complicated than this, but the little parable here, since we're talking about Good Samaritans. And what was the other parable you said you'd like to live by?
The prodigal son.
Right, the prodigal son. But wait a minute. Wait just a moment. The parable of the prodigal son is really just for a couple situations in life that you may never end up
with. It's not as applicable as the Good Samaritan.
It's just unconditional love, isn't it?
I just pulled that out of my ass. I had to have a couple of them.
I've found that one interesting. I had to ask a few people about it, especially after I read Castle Freeman's All That I Have, which I believe is a line from that story.
Oh, okay.
All That I Have Is Yours, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so it's about a sheriff who helps a not career criminal, but just a complete and utter delinquent in his town.
And isn't that more the Good Samaritan than the prodigal son?
No, because the prodigal son goes off and he wastes his
squanders his birthright and comes back.
And when the son comes back, the good son, the other son,
is like, hey, how about a little something for the effort?
I think I just realized. So the Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds album called The Good Son, is that the good son and the prodigal son?
It could be. I haven't listened to Nick Cave's lyrics on that album.
But, so he comes back and they make a feast and they give him all the stuff and everything I have is yours. And the good son's like, what the hell, Pop?
Yeah.
I've been here the whole time. Mm-hmm. And his dad basically says, when you're older, you'll understand, and gives another piece of meat to the prodigal son. It's a terrible story. It's just an awful story.
Yeah, it's
kind of
like the book of Job. If I were Job, I'd like, look, God, kiss my hairy ass. Can I move on?
You know, since we're going all around the block here, I remember you started saying things very early on in the run of this podcast.
Well, that's your first mistake, remembering crap I said years ago.
Did you know that we've made it to season 4?
And the authorities have not yet shut us down.
Because we're past 156 episodes.
That's amazing.
Which is, 156. Yeah. And because what's 3 times 52? 156,
So
we've done 3 seasons. We've started a 4th season.
Okay.
Of, you know, a year of episodes, 52.
I mean, what do we get? We got a coupon for that? Is there a Groupon for that?
Well, that and $4.15 will get you a sugary, diabetes-inducing Starbucks drink.
Excellent.
You said the Old Testament was a science textbook.
Yeah, I see it that way.
Yeah, and I have heard some people get very pissed off about that idea.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But I do think that the Bible is a psychology textbook.
I think it's that, too.
Yeah. I don't think it's a science textbook, though.
I think it's science, psychology, sociology.
It might be a history of science.
Philosophy.
But it's not a science textbook.
Metaphysics. Maybe it's... But science hadn't been invented yet. It's like I told my son. My son and I were talking. My 16-year-old son and I were talking about
Well, how could
it
be a science textbook if there was no science?
Well, because science is observing nature and postulating a hypothesis about it and eventually proving it. But, you know, for the first...
You're saying that the Bible was the first hypothesis.
Yeah, so maybe it was the... And let's face it, I'm an intelligent guy who knows a lot about science, but if this were 5,000 years ago...
Let's slow down for a moment.
I may or may not be an intelligent guy who knows something about science. And I'm looking up at the sky. I would have postulated that divine beings were responsible for this because I could conceive nothing else to describe it. I would have probably believed that hypothesis, and that's what people wrote. Heavenly bodies.
I'm
ending on.
Is that the original Hebrew or is that the King James Version?
This is the original Hebrew. No vowels.
Stop. Oh, shit. This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can't you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.